This week on Making Contact.
Firefighters are on the front lines of 14 major wildfires.
15 wildfires are on the move across seven states.
Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas.
These Colorado suburbs became a raging inferno.
This year, it made major news. But every summer, wildfires torch thousands of acres of land. The National Forest Service rushes to the rescue to save lives, homes, and communities. But is the agency's approach to fire doing more harm than good?
You've got these big, powerful political and economic interests locked into fighting fires, even in cases where it might be far cheaper for taxpayers, less risky for firefighters, and more ecologically beneficial to let fires burn more.
On this edition, producer George Lavender takes a closer look at the war on fire. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Today is day 8 of what firefighters have called the Chips Fire in northeastern California. I'm standing with Information Officer Howard Hunter, looking across a meadow to a smoky ridgeline, on the other side of which is the fire.
You can watch this big helicopter, heavy helicopter here, dipping now. He's dipping out of a stream or a pond. I can't see what it is right over there. And he's picking up hundreds of gallons of water at a time and in just minutes delivering it to the fire line.
Already the fire has burnt more than 13,000 acres in the Plumas and Lassen National Forests, and smoke can be seen for miles around. The helicopters are just part of a large force that's been marshaled to fight this fire. In a field just outside the small town of Quincy, it looks as if an army has arrived.
Just like the military, we have an operations section and a logistics section and a finance section, planning section, and everybody has their area of expertise and things that go with it, and so it is. It's like a military operation, bringing in a city, if you will, to fight the fire.
Steve Barr is operations section chief at the fire. All around Quincy, there are signs thanking the firefighters, but the largest is a red, white, and blue sign that covers the entire side of 66-year-old Bill Alexander's house. It reads, "God bless our troops and firefighters."
We've had it up probably for 10 or 15 years. Both my sons have worked in fire for at least one season. We put it up way before they started working there. It's just there was some local Plumas firefighters that were killed, and we put it up after that.
Why was that important to you to paint that sign?
Well, you know, let them know we appreciate what they do. You know, it's somebody does, you know.
And you put the troops and the firefighters together. Do you see those two as related?
Oh, yeah. They're both out there protecting us, you know, so they're both dangerous.
For most of the last 100 years, the U.S. Forest Service has been waging war on fire. With bulldozers, aeroplanes, helicopters, and thousands of firefighters, they race to put out fires all over the country. Neil Lawrence, the Forestry Project Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council, explains.
The Forest Service started doing fire suppression in the early part of the 20th century, and within about 20 years had adopted a policy of trying to put out every fire by 10 a.m. the morning after it was first spotted. They had a very, very aggressive policy. It was adopted, I think, very largely to protect timber resources on both public and private lands.
But that approach was supposed to have changed in 1995, when all the main federal land management agencies agreed that fire was a necessary part of the ecosystem.
It used to be that we used to fight fires, like put all fires bad, and the public is starting to understand, you know, that we are going to, like I said, manage some of these fires, you know, in the less populated areas and wilderness areas, and that fire is part of the ecosystem, part of what we need to get back into nature to, you know, it's been kept out for 100 and some years now, and so it needs to be used as a tool for the environment.
It's all a far cry from Smokey the Bear and his message of wildfire prevention. But as it turns out, fire has always played an important role in the landscape. A chainsaw splutters into life in a redwood forest. But this isn't a logging party. The chainsaw operator is Chuck Striplin, an environmental scientist with the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Striplin is here as part of his mission to learn more about the history of fire in California.
So we found a blowdown old growth redwood here in Big Basin State Park. And right now we're trying to identify where on the tree we're actually going to take a sample.
Sawing through the big tree takes a long time. Stripling has to stop regularly to clear the thick redwood sawdust clogging the chainsaw. But 30 minutes later... it's what's inside the tree that interests Stripling. He's looking for fire scars, marks left behind inside the tree after a forest fire, and he's not disappointed.
So this one's real prominent where you can actually see kind of the black char line. Yeah.
Can you describe what the scars look like?
Well, they're the most prominent ones look like kind of a black band within the ring structure of the tree.
And what can these fire scars tell you about the tree and about this forest?
Well, they give you an idea of what the past environment was like in relationship to fire. So one of the things that we're finding through our work is that fires prior to 1769, prior to Spanish contact, were much more frequent. And that's knowing that the source of fires hasn't changed. People were and remain today the primary source of ignition for all fires in this largely lightning-free region. So what this gives us an indication of is how frequently people were burning.
Jokingly, Stripling calls the tree samples he takes redwood cookies. Even with the cookie broken into smaller pieces, it takes four of us to lift the largest quarter onto his truck. He'll take them back to the lab, where he'll sand them down to coffee table quality and analyze the rings to determine which years the scars came from. And he's already found a pattern.
Especially once you average them together, you can kind of see a point where the frequent fires cease. And you get much more widely spaced, larger, hotter, more intense fires post-colonization. Fires has always been a part of landscape processes here. It will always be. It's just kind of a matter of on whose terms.
In one corner of the Yellow Creek Spike Camp at the Chips Fire, a group of women wearing green hats are assembling cardboard boxes. Their company, called The Natives, is a frequent sight around California forest fires. I sat down and asked Laura Borden what their role is here.
We do supplies, camp. Sometimes we do help with the kitchen, sometimes we help with facilities. Right now we're making cubies for their water.
Carmen Moon is the crew boss of The Natives.
The reason why we came up with this name, because we're Native Americans, Native Californians, Native USA. So why we started this, because the reservation that we live on is basically very poverty stricken. So this provides work for a lot of the young people. It's a great thing. You enjoy it and it gets in your blood, and I love this. And
yes, and you whine when you get left behind.
On the Hooper Reservation, where most of the group is from, fire is also used as a tool.
There's a lot of basketry work going on with the Native Americans. So when there's a burn area, a lot of it's cultural burn areas, and they go in and burn certain area. They get their sticks. In the other areas they burn, they get their bare grass. So they use this and they're making their basket. So
you can't use the grass unless it's burnt. It has to be burnt. And the same as the sticks, because it kills all the bugs and gives a new growth a good start.
Carmen Moon thinks land managers have started to learn from indigenous people's use of fire.
Well, for us, a long time ago, we always did our own controlled burning. The Native Americans did their own controlled burning, and we never had a lot of this that's going on today. But they figured out that the Americans weren't so dumb after all. They knew what they were doing when they were burning and the reasons they were burning. So now they're going back to that same philosophy of it.
But allowing fires to burn in the woods isn't a decision everyone appreciates. At the Rolling Thunder Cafe in Quincy, the staff told me that while firefighters brought more business, numbers of tourists were down.
Now we're up here visiting, we're up here on vacation to have a nice time, and we've had the smoke come down in here and mess up our views of the mountain.
George Locke came to Quincy with his family.
They should have taken care of it at the very beginning. I was a firefighter in San Bernardino County for 6 years, and that's all I ever saw the Forest Service do.
I asked him what the smoke had been like over the past few days.
It's been a letdown just to the fact that it's like I said, gotten rid of our views of the mountains a couple nights. The sun going down turns to bright red, and the moon coming up is red, and it's not, the smells aren't there, it's just now you're smelling the smoke. You don't get to smell the pines that we're camping under, and it takes away from the ambiance that's here.
While smoke may be a problem for some people, Neil Lawrence of the Natural Resources Defense Council says that fires are absolutely necessary.
All other things being equal, the thing that determines how hot a fire is and how hard to control is how long it's been since the same part of the forest burnt. Fires eat up wood, brush, and other vegetative material that serves as fuels for forest fires. Between fires, all that material grows. So the more recent a fire has been, the less fuel there is for the next fire. And the flip side of that, of course, is the longer it's been, the more fuel there is for the next fire. And everything else being equal, the longer it's been, the hotter and harder to control the next fire is going to be. That means that every time we suppress a fire, we're making the next fire worse.
Almost a century of putting out fires has turned forests in the American West into tinderboxes, and Forest Service scientists say that the fire seasons are already 70 days longer as a result of the changing climate.
I think we're at a critical juncture where, because of the buildup of fuels in forests and because of the drying and the increased temperatures that we can expect with climate change, forest fires are going to become more common, larger, more difficult to control than they've been in the past. If we don't get fire back in the woods now, as things warm and get more dry, the further buildup of fuels in those forests are going to make it not only impossible to protect our communities, but I think they're going to make it impossible to get fire back in the woods at all.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
Out of sale here, we have all sorts of candy. It's a sweet spot. It's the sweetest spot in the whole county. We're the only candy.
Amy Carey grew up in Quincy and has grown used to smoky summers and the firefighting they bring. She's put a hand-painted sign outside her store.
It says firefighters thank you, and basically it was put out because my dad was a firefighter and he got really injured on what was seemingly a very routine time, and he's still not well to this day, and that was 15 years ago. So no matter what people think about firefighters out there, they're always in danger.
What do you think the average American view of firefighters is?
I think for the most part, most people see firefighters as hard workers and maybe the term hero. I don't know, I get really emotional. I don't know, it's kind of one of those things when your family is involved in any kind of service like that, it's like you don't know the end result of it until they're home. My husband's also a volunteer firefighter here in town, and it's that unending story of, okay, hopefully they'll come home.
If the Forest Service is waging war on fire, then firefighters are the frontline soldiers. Almost every year, firefighters die on the job. Between 2000 and 2010, 82 wildland firefighters died working for the federal government, and hundreds more were injured.
You certainly don't see upper-class kids in wildland fire. It's too dangerous.
That's Phil, a senior fire manager with over two decades' experience in firefighting. He would only agree to be interviewed if I didn't use his real name or voice.
A person could have permanent respiratory ailments, permanent debilitating injuries, or even be killed. And you know, the one percenters, their kids don't do that kind of work. That's just not allowed. You know, rank and file firefighters, I'd say they're mostly working poor and working class.
The more aggressive the approach to firefighting, the greater danger firefighters are in. That's one reason Phil is concerned the Forest Service seems to be returning to its old habits. At the start of the 2012 fire season, the agency sent round a memo that advocated for a more aggressive approach to fires. Neil Lawrence explains.
The memo heralds a substantial change of fire response policy by the Forest Service, which had been trying in recent years, when it could responsibly do so, to let fires burn. Under the new policy, essentially all fires will be extinguished as soon as possible, including fires that burn far away from homes and communities, indeed fires deep in wilderness areas.
I asked the Chief of the Forest Service, Tom Tidwell, about the significance of the memo.
Well, the memo just recognized the fire season we were up to, and it wasn't anything different than what we normally do. When we get to a certain level of activity, we have the number of fires that we have on the landscape this year, it reduces the opportunity we have to manage fire in the backcountry, manage fire in the wilderness areas.
In the United States, 2012 saw the highest average temperatures for July on record. Chief Tidwell told me that those conditions made it necessary to suppress more fires.
If the memo, maybe the intent wasn't maybe as clear, but I tell you, as I talked with my folks at from our regional foresters and forest supervisors, they understand what we're up against, and they understand that this is just a recognition of the conditions that we're facing. But this is not a change. There's no change in our policy.
You can't read that memo and think that there hasn't been a change in policy. The agency has been trying to let forest fires burn where it could in recent years. And now it's saying, even in the most extreme situations, in backwoods far away from people, we're putting those fires out. That unquestionably is a big change.
And Scott Stevens, Associate Professor of Fire Science at the University of California, Berkeley, says the change in tactics sets a bad precedent.
It's been a dry year, not everywhere, but a lot of places. We know that climate change is impacting this. We expect longer fire seasons and warmer conditions. And then the idea then becomes in my mind, well, if this year is a year that we think we need to initial attack everything because of cost, what about the next year? What about 3 years from now? We're going to have this as basically commonplace. You know, we're going to have warmer conditions, droughtier times. So if we continue to think that we're going to go to this mode of pure suppression somehow to contain costs, we're basically headed down the wrong road.
Neil Lawrence says there's an economic motivation for the policy change.
The Forest Service has found in recent years that its most reliable source of funding is funding to suppress fires. And as a result, today, more than half of the agency's budget is related one way or the other to suppressing fires. This is a memo that says, in essence, we're going to do more of that. And when we're going to do more of that, partly because people are concerned about it, but I think it would be naive to think that there wasn't anybody in the agency who thought about fire suppression as being a meal ticket and more suppression as being more meals.
Among those who stand to benefit from increased fire suppression are private firefighting companies, who in recent years have seen an increased share of the Forest Service's $2 billion budget for fires.
We make up probably 25% of that budget. The vast majority of that budget goes to aerial firefighting support.
Debbie Miley is Executive Director of the National Wildfire Suppression Association, which represents more than 150 private firefighting companies. I asked her if she expected her members to benefit from the apparent increase in fire suppression.
Probably in some ways. You have to keep in mind also that the agencies are also under the gun with Congress to make sure that they cost-effectively fight these fires.
There's no doubt that suppressing fires is expensive. In just 8 days, the CHIPS fire had racked up a $4 million bill. At the Quincy Airfield, I met Darrell Stockdale. Before he retired, he was a division chief in California's Lassen National Forest. Now he owns an air management company.
I'm a contractor. When I retired, I had a specialty in aviation management, so I pursued that and went ahead and built the communication trailers to allow the hull-based personnel to work out of there.
This is Darrell Stockdale's third fire in 2012. Having worked on both sides of the public-private divide, I asked him what he thought about the use of private contractors.
It works out well to have both opportunities. And it's It's very costly to keep the pilots, aircraft maintained, the pilots current, qualified, on tap, out of the taxpayer's pot. So trying to do it all on the taxpayer's dole under agency equipment is not the best way, I think. I think it's good to have a mix of resources available.
We obviously would like to see these guys utilized as much as possible, keeping in mind that we have always understood that we are not utilized until all the federal agencies have been utilized. You know, we're not there to replace them. We're there to complement their resources when their resources are stretched thin.
You know, I served on the last government crew that was, the next season canceled, and that work just kind of turned over to private contractors.
Timothy Inglesby is a former firefighter and co-founder of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. He says that the private firefighting corporations are changing the direction of firefighting for the worse.
You know, private companies, corporations, only get their contracts, only get paid when they're fighting fire. And so it's kind of vested economic stakes in perpetuating firefighting, even in cases where it might be, far cheaper for taxpayers, less risky for firefighters, and more ecologically beneficial for the land, the ecosystem, to let fires burn more. We're kind of in this conundrum of scientifically understanding we need more fire on the ground, realizing that the high social, economic, ecological cost of continuing to fight fires and exclude fires, but you've got these big, powerful political and economic interests still locked into fighting fires.
The CHIPS fire scorched an area twice the size of San Francisco before it was contained. As Forest Service fire engines sped by, I spoke with Lorena Gorbett, a member of the Mountain Maidu.
We would not have put out, any natural fires, but natural fires would not get large because we kept the forests clean of a lot of the fuels that would burn. And so when our fires would burn, they would just be burning the duff on the ground, they'd burn close to the ground. Most of your Maidu fires, if you watch them when they go burn, they're slow moving, and they leave islands around plants. You can walk along with a fire and direct it, rake it to the areas you want to go. You can rake it back on itself and it would stop because your flames were probably not over 18 inches high. It was just burning the small stuff on the ground, because if there was anything large to be burned, we had already taken care of it.
Prior to European settlement, many tribes in the American West carried out burns on their land, including the tribe Chuck Striplin is from, the Amamutsin.
The people that showed up on these shores in 1769, one viewed the native people as heathens, as godless, as less than, as unsophisticated. And so their regime of watershed management was also viewed as the same. So the people came in and imposed their own land tenure system, their own understanding of their relationship with watersheds and natural resources, and imposed that on this land. And to a large degree, it hasn't really worked out. It's a long, tedious process to try and understand what it was like a mere 273 years ago, which is probably only about that far on this tree. It's about 6 inches.
How would you characterize European attitudes to fire?
Now or then?
Maybe start with then.
Then, fearful. I guess I'd have to say the same about now. Misunderstanding, displaced anger in many cases. Yeah, it's complicated.
Striplin is one of many fire scientists trying to figure out what role fire used to play in the American West. His redwood cookies may provide one piece in that puzzle and help plan for the future.
Climate change is going to produce conditions conducive to much larger, much longer burning fires across the land. That's not going to change. What has to change is society and its entire philosophy and relationship with wildland fire. Our vision is that someday the very term firefighter will be obsolete. The term firefighter will be replaced with something like fire guider, steering fires as opposed to abruptly stopping them.
At least one Californian tribe is attempting to do just that. I joined Brent Johnson, a National Parks botanist, on a hike up into the Pinnacles National Monument, where the Amamutsin tribe carried out a traditional burn in December 2011.
What you can see here, where we're standing, are deer grass plants that were burned in December. We expect to see these put up quite a few flowers in the next year. The main impetus for this prescribed burn was to burn the deer grass to manage it for basketry materials.
With the deer grass returning, so too is some of the knowledge of traditional land management and the use of fire.
Fire has been in our culture, basically from the creation of our tribe.
Valentin Lopez is chairman of the Amamutsin tribe.
It was given to us to help us manage the land.
Part of the objective here was by working with and planning this whole project with the National Park Service fire staff as well as the Amamutsin, was really bringing back a process. Throughout California, Native Americans were burning every year. Yeah, they were burning, and then one year it would just stop. In some small way, we're restoring something that disappeared over 100 years ago.
Fire's role in shaping the landscape depends on where you are. Different ecosystems react differently to fire. But for much of the 20th century, the response to fire was always the same. Brent Johnson says we have to be careful not to repeat the same one-size-fits-all approach to the environment that led the Forest Service to suppress all fires. What worked in the past may not have the same outcome today or in years to come.
When you take a species or take a process out, you can't just stick it back in and expect everything to reassemble to the way it was before. It's not as simple as just, well, if we get the fire back in there, it's all going to go back to the way it was. To me, it's kind of like trying to unscramble an egg.
Returning fire to a few acres of the American West is not going to bring about the change many believe is necessary, but it could be a start.
Everyone is starting to realize that we cannot continue on this path, that something has to be done. The big fires and stuff like that, now just more evidence that things have to change. And we hope that people are open-minded enough to consider the way that the Native Americans used to use fire to manage the land and how it was successfully done for thousands of years.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. The Burning Issue, America's War on Fire, was produced by George Lavender. This edition of Making Contact was partially funded by listener donations to Spot.us. Special thanks to Penny DeWind and Don Kyle. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.